Welcome back, movie fans. Here we are, back to the podcast with another review. This time, it is an unusual one. It is a strange beast of a movie. It's Aquaman meets the X-Files meets Made in Manhattan. It is The Shape of Water. I'm Byron.
And I am Bear, as always. Welcome back, everyone. Thanks for joining us. This is an unusual one, but I mean, I think we're both kind of big fans of the director, and we've done a Pan's Labyrinth podcast, which obviously had very sort of similar feeling, same director, same man, Doug Jones, you know, the creature. Mm-hmm. So I mean, it's not a completely new outing for us, but it's certainly no Justice League or Marvel film. This is a bit different. I think for me, I think the reason I wanted to take a look at this is because every year the Oscars come close, and I always take a look at the ones that are scoring heavily or presumed to score heavily. Obviously, it's worth saying at the point of recording, the Oscars haven't happened. It's early Feb. They may have happened by the time you listen to this, by the time I release it, but that's another story. But at this point, I think Shape of Water runs the leaderboard for the Oscars for the most amount of nominations, with I think something like 13, followed by something like The Darkest Hour. So I always take a look at these films because it's interesting to see where people are kind of putting their money. And this one I genuinely really, really liked. And I have to say, in previous years, I've looked at the films that have either won or the films that have been up for a lot of nominations, and I've not taken to them so warmly because, you know, they're difficult Oscar films because they have to tick a lot of boxes, but they're not always that sort of quote marks entertaining. They tick a lot of boxes in terms of, you know, cinematography and beautiful music and character development, but they're never as entertaining as, you know, you want from maybe another type of film. But this, I felt, ticked all of those boxes and was still really, really entertaining, and I just really, really enjoyed watching it. So I think, given our history with Guillermo del Toro, I can't pronounce his name.
It's up and down, Bear, for me. It's up and down.
What, the film?
It's up and down. No, the history of del Toro.
Okay.
It's up and down, if I'm being honest with you, because
What are some of the low?
Well, it's very confident in him with things like Pan's Labyrinth. Mm. When he I don't know if he was kidnapped or something, but he ended up in Hollywood making Hollywood star movies like the
Pacific Rim.
You know, I'm like, the hell, this guy's, what in the shit is going on now? You know, so I for a while lost faith in Guillermo del Toro, right? But for movie fans to understand, this film is a true Guillermo del Toro movie.
Definitely.
Like in the Pan's Labyrinth side of things. But as far as I'm concerned, this is the only kind of movie he should be doing. Mm. Yeah, all this other stuff he's doing, all these other things he's flirting around with, yeah, are a distraction from his capability and a waste of everyone's damn time.
What did you
Because think? Michael Bay could be doing all those silly projects, and only he can do things of this nature.
What did you think of Hellboy?
Yeah, I'm okay with Hellboy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm okay with Hellboy.
Because I was disappointed. I actually really liked Hellboy, and I think that's kind of a nice compromise because it's sort of this world, because it's got the sort of the wonderful design that only he can do so well. But it's also got that kind of commercial Hollywood sort of vibe going as well.
It's weird enough, though.
What I find interesting about Hellboy is that he made Hellboy 1 and 2, and everyone seemed keen for him to make a Hellboy 3, and he didn't do it. For whatever reason, he didn't seem to want to do it. I believe Ron Perlman was up for it, and the rest of the cast were up for it. Hellboy 3 never came, but now there's a new Hellboy coming from a completely new director, new cast. Incidentally, starring David Harbour, who we've just seen in Stranger Things, he's the new Hellboy. But he is bringing us a Pacific Rim 2, which I find really odd, because I think Hellboy was a real product of passion for him, he loves the comics and he loved the series. So I'm surprised he didn't take up the reins of the third film. And I'm surprised he is making a Pacific Rim 2. And like you say, it is, maybe it does just come down to which has the bigger paycheck, which is a shame because I think he can give us a lot more than that, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe he got drunk one night and signed a contract he shouldn't have. It does happen.
It does.
You know, it does happen. So let's get into this Shape of Water. So it's a funny old movie, isn't it? It's like, it's not normal. It's definitely not a normal movie.
I mean, it was surprising to me because it's... No, you're right. It's not normal.
And on it's the fucking not normal, mate.
And on the face of it, we've got this story about...
Let's talk about the story.
A woman who kind of... So she's a lonely cleaner who works for a top secret research facility. We should actually say, spoilers throughout, obviously, and we appreciate that this film has had a very, very staggered release from lots of... It's spread over several months of release. So it's been released in America and over on that side. It's not... It's sort of coming here and then the rest of Europe's following later. So if you've not seen it, obviously go and watch it. Come back to us after. Full spoilers lie ahead. You've been warned. So yeah, story-wise, it's about this kind of lonely cleaner who works in a top secret kind of research facility. I'm guessing set in the sort of 1960s.
This is the 60s, yeah.
And they bring in this highly top secret creature, you know, amphibian creature. And she basically sparks a relationship with this creature. She falls for it, breaks it out, and then has relationships with it.
She has it round to dinner, Ben.
In her flat.
She has dinner with Aquaman.
Yes, she does. Well, she has more than dinner. She has. Fun times.
There is. Is that classed reality?
Well,
sorry, I don't know if we can say that on the podcast.
I don't know. Well, this one's going to be
R-rated.
God. They're all R-rated. Do you hear how much we swear? Jesus. They're all R-rated. Bestiality is what he said to me. I don't know, if I'm honest.
This movie contains a sex scene between
a woman and an
aquatic beast and a human woman.
Yes.
I'm like, okay, we're actually... Because when it happens, because she breaks... Oh, I don't know where to begin. But it's a story that just goes from one thing to another, right? It gets more ludicrous as you go, but you absolutely cannot stop watching it. It's the damnedest thing.
All that's kind of right on the face of it. All that story there about her and him, that's essentially what the story... But then underneath, there's all this extra stuff going on because there's... Obviously, being set in the 60s, there's a lot of themes that they've brought forward. Like, I like... the Michael Shannon, we need to talk about him in a minute, but he refers to the cleaners as the sort of the help a couple of times, which I think is very... It's very of the time, you know. One of them, the black lady, I forget her name, she was in a film called Hidden Figures, basically playing the same character. Set, you know, when coloured people, black people, didn't have the same sort of rights, and they really sort of play on that fact. And they're referred to as the help, and, you know, it's kind of deeply offensive now. But I found it interesting they brought that sort of tone into it, the sort of the racial class tone into it as well. And then there's the sort of the gay neighbour who's struggling with his sort of sexuality and relationships, and there's all these kind of weird little subplot lines going on underneath this already very strange, very very strange plot of a woman and a Aquaman. It's a terribly strange film, but brilliant. I mean,
you know what I think is clever about this movie? Everyone's the bad guy.
That's very true.
Let me explain what I mean by that.
Yeah,
everyone's the bad guy. Everyone's the bad guy. So you've got it from every angle, depending on who you are, when you step into it. This is actually either incidental or very, very clever, or Del Toro is very clever. I suspect it could be that. But if you think about it, so Zelda, who is the black cleaning lady, right, in the plot, she has a friend. She's friends with Eliza, okay, who's the lead actress, who's the clean lady that decides that falls in love with the aquatic creature. So Zelda is the bad guy from society's point of view because she's sort of racially a minority and to be looked down upon, which is why when there's a scene in the diner when black people come in, they can't sit there, they get asked to leave. in that respect, right? So she's looked down upon, right? She's like a bad kind of character, right? Eliza, can't speak. So she's a mute. So she's got this thing as well, where again she's like sort of looked as a low life form by the Richard Strickland, Michael Shannon character who runs facility, likes to take advantage of people like that, like sexually. He's weird. He's weird with women, you know. Then you've got Aquaman, of course, who's a strange creature from, you know, may as well be from another dimension. But he's obviously observed by by both the Russians and by the US government, and they want ultimately decide to kill him. He can't be owned by anyone because it might be too dangerous, you know. Then you've got Richard Strickland, okay, who's trying to run the facility, right? Now he's a bad guy because he gets bitten by the aquatic creature, but he's also got problems from his higher up boss as well. He's like colonel, was it general or something, Hoyt, or whatever. So he's a bad guy because he's failing to do his job properly. So everywhere you look, then you've got the neighbor, the gay neighbor, he's bad. That's at that time in society, yeah, was a big taboo, so that was a no-no. So it's interesting because for every step,
and the spy, the Russian,
yes, who's of course, so you think he's a good guy because he's a research guy, and now he turns out to be a Russian spy. So yeah. every angle, it's like it's incredible, really, because everyone, depending on who you are in the movie, everybody else is potentially a bad guy, you know, at any one time. That's clever, right?
It's also very fashionable these days to have things like that. I mean, there's a lot of films and TV series where that's the case. I think since kind of Breaking Bad, we've had a kind of surge in films and TV series where there aren't any good guys. There's a lot of bad guys, and it's kind of who do we like the most out of the bad guys, or which side do we side with more? But they're both bad, and I think this is kind of following in that theme, which again puts him. He's a very clever man, is Del Toro. You know,
yeah,
he knows how to make a film, and he knows how to kind of keep it very on point, you know, thematically.
Well, listen, I think everyone can go along with the research lab, the two characters, the breakout, because everyone's got that whole, you know, should animals, etc., wild creatures be kept? Okay, I get it. So everyone's on board up to that point. Break him out, and she's checking the river levels. We can get him back into the water and all that. So it's all orchestrated, right? Now, the bit where it becomes a little strange, right, is, I'll be honest with you, is when she first has that first sort of fantasy about the creature, where they're like going to like a black and white movie and they're like dancing together, doing like a tap routine or something. I'm like, oh, I'm not taking enough drugs to comprehend what's going on now. Your thoughts?
Well, this is where, I don't know, this is where the Oscar thing comes in really, really heavy, because it seems like that I think, I'm like you, I kind of think, okay, what's happening here? But dare I say, I don't want to get in trouble, but like Oscar-y people, Oscars boards love shit like that. They love film noir, stuff like that, you know, beautifully made. The film was beautiful. I mean, to look at, if you've screenshotted every, you know, freeze frame of the film, it could be a coffee art book, you know. It was beautifully put together. There was never a shot that wasn't thought about in terms of lighting and the camera angle and the way the light just sort of softly beams off the right person's head. It was beautifully put together, and stuff like that is what, dare I say it, the Oscars boards kind of really go for, really look at. So I feel like scenes like that, whenever I see them in films like this, I always feel like they're put in with that in mind. But I don't want to discredit him, because I actually thought the film was really, really good. But I've seen films in the past that I just think, are you just trying to kind of get this streamlined into the Oscars by making a film like this? Because, you know, you go and see a kind of normal film, and they're the ones that don't get looked at. So it's like, there's obviously something about these ones that this is what they want to see. You know, this is what they need to be to be in that sort of realm of films. But don't get me wrong, I thought it was beautifully made, but I agree with you that in fact that scene reminded me of a cross between Singing in the Rain and something from Young Frankenstein. Do you remember when he dances with, it was very odd, but it was kind of nice at the same time, because it was just a fantasy, and it was sort of nice to see her exploring out a little bit. Obviously her character was very restrictive. Sally Hawkins, as we spoke about in the last podcast, is not a mute. She's a very, very, very good actress, So to play a character with essentially just her eyes and a bit of sign language is no easy feat, I don't think. So I think that sort of dance sequence was actually quite nice because it meant she could kind of open out a little bit.
Let's talk about Michael Shannon.
Oh, that man is brilliant. I love Michael Shannon, and I love him even more now I've seen him in this. I have to say, I loved him as Zod in Man of Steel.
Yeah.
I also watched a film where he played Elvis Presley in a film called Elvis versus Nixon, or Nixon versus Elvis or something.
Elvis and Nixon, yeah.
Kind of low budget thing. Yeah. And he was brilliant in that, playing, you know, a character we all know and love so much. And in this, he's just such an unlikable man, isn't he? He even does that well. Like, he's a good looking dude and he's a great actor and he's been in so many great films, and in this he's just such a, you just want to punch him so hard all the time. He does such a good job in this, you know. I'm sad that I don't think he's up for any sort of award for this film.
Yeah.
That's what makes me sad. She is, Sally Hawkins, but Michael Shannon isn't, and that makes me sad because I think he should be.
Yeah. It's, as we said before, it's not easy to find good bad guys. And if you find a good bad guy,
yeah,
then you want to hold on to them. And hopefully, you know, they'll appear, you know, time over time. But I think he did a really, really good job in this movie. And, you know, it's one of those ones where you'd think in a movie that like this, that what you're going to have is lots of guns and lots of shooting when you're dealing with a military installation. And that would be the way it could have been made if a different director was doing something, or a different writer was doing it. You'd have lots and lots of bad guys, because that's got to be good, right? An army of bad guys, all with guns, all with shooting, up against a chase scene and this kind of thing. And it was interesting because here, they didn't really do that. They just had him being all of them in one. And everyone else was kind of like a bit more scientific that was around him, like, should we do that? Is that a good idea? Do I have to get, it's my car? Do I have to get out of the car? Yeah. You know, that scene where they're like doing the pursuit, he's like, do I have to get, it's my car? He's have to get out of the car. So just one, just to have the confidence to rely on just one character to basically do all that, it shows a pretty solid, you know, a pretty good vote of confidence for this actor and for this part.
Yes.
You know, so I think that's interesting. I'd be interested to see what roles now generate for Michael Shannon off the back of this movie, because other people will be looking at him and saying, you know what, we could use him in something. You know, he's got that sort of tall, broody look, you know, that very serious look about him. And I think there's a bit of a commodity for those that can do that well. Let me give you a good example, right? Yeah. Let me tell you how this could have worked better for everyone, right? So when we reviewed Logan, okay, who was the bad guy in Logan? Richard E. Grant.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. It would have been better if Michael Shannon had played that part.
Yeah, okay.
Because Richard Grant just felt a bit fumbling and a bit, it just didn't work for me. It didn't feel very serious. It just felt a bit like, really?
I mean, it's difficult, isn't it? Because...
No, it is difficult. It is difficult, of course.
It's difficult because this character was so different compared to, say, a sort of villain you'd get in a superhero film. Michael Shannon's kind of played the villain in a superhero film because he was Zod in Man of Steel, and that was obviously very different because it was very shouty and very like, kneel before Zod, you know, like the Terrence Stamp thing, you know. It's you've got to be very sort of melodramatic if you're doing it. But what I liked about this, he played it very, he downplayed it, but he was saying such awful things that it just made you hate him, and that in a kind of level is, it makes him more of a scary ass man.
Yeah.
You know, because he's...
Well, I think that's a kind of a Tarantino thing where the dialogue is everything, and that tells you the character rather than the big dramatic shoot 'em up scenes.
Yeah.
You know? You can do that as well, but sometimes just the right few lines of the right nature just sets the whole thing for you.
I agree.
So here's a question, right? This is going to obviously... this is going to be the bit bare.
Yeah.
This is the bit now, right? As I understood it, Andy Serkis doesn't he do all of these?
Oh, creatures? Don't. Do you know what I had written in my notes? And I wanted to come on to Doug Jones, and I just feel really sorry for the man all the fucking time, because I love Doug Jones so much, and I bet you If we walked out into the street right now, everyone will know who Andy Serkis is. Everyone. I'm not taking anything away from Andy
Serkis.
Listen,
we need a man to get into a monkey suit. The hand goes up.
They both led very, very similar careers, let's be honest. Okay, so for those of you who don't know, and let's be honest, that's probably most of you because Doug Jones can't catch a break. Doug Jones was the man in the fish suit. Now, him and Guillermo del Toro do this a lot. They work together a lot. He does a lot of these characters. So if you think of the sort of the... What was the character in Pan's Labyrinth called? The thing with the hands? The creepy...
I don't know. The no-eyed thing or something or other.
The if you think of the famous sort of thing in Pan's Labyrinth...
I shall find it.
He was also the fawn in Pan's Labyrinth, which is a separate character. So he played two big, heavily made-up characters. Now, the difference with Doug Jones compared to Andy Serkis is Doug Jones is always...
The Pale Man.
Doug Jones is always in there. Whereas Andy Serkis, he sort of does the motion capture thing. From what I've read about Guillermo del Toro, his directorial choices, is he always likes to have a sort of man in suit as it's going to look on screen on set, whereas Andy Serkis will turn up in his pajamas with green dots and it's finished later in post. So they are very different. Doug Jones is more of a kind of like, you know, performer, if you like. He's a physical performer. He's always in the suit. He was also the similar character, actually, the amphibian style character in the Hellboy series, but he's been around for years, man. I mean, I was just looking at IMDb the other day and was looking up on one of the old Batman films, and he was in one of those as a clown performer. He's done loads, and he's recently been seen in his sort of true human form in Star Wars Discovery. I want to say Discovery, the new Netflix series. Star Trek Discovery. He was given a role in that. So yeah, I feel sorry for him, man, because he's always just it always knocks it out of the park in my eyes. And I'm like someone who likes to know who's the man behind the mask sort of thing. So I always look him up, and it's always the same guy, you know. But yeah, he's never ever going to be as well known as Andy Serkis because he was, you know, because he's got, I guess, Gollum, and Andy Serkis has got Star Wars and Marvel and King Kong all behind him, and Planet of the Apes. Whereas Doug Jones has got these kind
Snoke
of...
Snoke and the whole thing, yeah. Doug Jones
has got these sort of smaller, you know, these smaller sort of offbeat, culty type characters, but just brilliant, you know. And he's such a true performer in what must be a heavily restrictive costume, you know, whatever, whether it's costume or makeup or a bit of both. It must be awful to be in there, absolutely awful. And he's acting his arse off, you know, with Sally Hawkins. And
sometimes underwater too.
He's brilliant. He's absolutely brilliant, yeah.
Right, so a quick shout out to him because he's going to be in a movie that's labelled as in post-production at the moment for 2018, which I think I might actually be excited about, which is called Nosferatu.
Which was the original,
if you remember that, the original Mr. Vampire movie there.
Well, that's the sort of thing I can see him just doing in his sleep, yeah. You know. So, good for him.
Looking forward to that. So that's a little shout out to him. We'll see if we can check that out when that comes out and have get a good review on that one for him.
But I mean, if you look at his picture on IMDb.
He looks peculiar, doesn't he?
He looks like the character he's just played. They always look kind of like he does. You know, he's obviously... He's really tall. He's really thin.
Sort of the eyes.
Yeah, he's got very striking eyes, and you know, unlike Andy Serkis, who looks kind of just like a kind of regular dude you'd meet down the pub, Doug Jones looks a bit more kind of as these characters do. You know, like he's very sort of they're obviously designed with him in mind, around his sort of build. But yeah, if you don't know who he is, go and check him out because the man deserves some love. He deserves some love and appreciation for what he does.
Yeah, no, right on, buddy. So what, do we recommend people go and see this film?
Well, again, I mean, this point they probably have.
It's a strange film.
I definitely think they would, because not often do I get to a year where I watch the films that are up for best Oscars and I enjoy as many as I did this year. I felt spoiled for choice this year, you know, with the likes of this and Get Out and Darkest Hour. I felt these are legitimately really, really good films. I don't feel like they're... I just don't want to be too offensive, but my opinion of it is that I feel like a lot of Oscar-y type films can be quite pretentious, you know, and that is just my opinion. So I'm really sorry if that offends anyone. I am sorry, because I know a lot of people really love them, but I do find that, you know, that they can be very, very pretentious, because they, as I said before, they're trying to sort of tick as many boxes, and it in a lot of cases they sort of forget about the entertainment factor of it being a movie that we need to go out and watch and enjoy and be entertained by, and they forget about things like basic stuff like the story, and you know, and I felt kind of like that with The Revenant. We're off topic here, but you know, I felt like that with The Revenant, you know, the Leonardo DiCaprio that won a few years back, you know. I felt like it ticked every single box, but it wasn't easy or enjoyable to watch, in my opinion. But I feel like this, and a few others this year, I truly enjoyed watching this film. I didn't at any point feel like this was a chore, like, oh, I've just got to watch this because it's in the Oscars. I would watch this again, and I'll own it when it comes out on DVD. I think it's brilliant, brilliantly made, and it looks great, and I think all the performances in it were just exceptional. Really, really exceptional.
Good.
How did you think?
I'm down with it. I just found a couple bits of it just a bit strange, yeah. You know, just a bit weird. It just threw me in a couple places. But now that, you know, I've got a heads up on it, it's like, it's not actually going to happen, is it? They're not actually, and then they do, you know, like, okay. So I kind of thought, I guess I'm all right with it. It just, like I say, it just threw me a couple times.
I think
it wasn't exactly the film I thought I was going to get in those two moves that he did, but maybe that's the genius of it. You know, he's bored of doing the normal, and we critique Hollywood for the formula and da da da. So I guess we shouldn't be complaining. I'm just saying, yeah, I kind of didn't see that coming.
But also, and fair play to him, like you said at the beginning about how he kind of moved, he had a few years. Now, he is bringing a specific Rim 2 this year, and hats off to him that he still is doing kind of both, you know. Like, he's doing Pacific Rim 2, but he's also finding time in his schedule to do films like this, which is obviously films that he really wants to do and passionate projects. What I love about him, Del Toro, that is his way to develop a story and a film in the ways that I've not seen from many other directors. It's something we actually talked about with Valerian on the kind of opposite side of the coin, because what I like about Guillermo del Toro is he's done interviews before where he's shown people like his notebooks, you know, of say a film, say Pan's Labyrinth or this, you know, he'll take a notebook and it's just full of sketches that he's started and then come back to, and creatures he's designed or set pieces that he's thought up that he wants to be in a film, and very colourful and very weird and wonderful. And there was a bit of trivia that I read on this where he came up with 40 plus page backstories for each of the characters, and he'd say to the actors, it's up to you whether you take them or not. Like, so some of the actors said, for example, the one that played her neighbor, the gay neighbor,
yep,
he refused to take the backstory. He said, whatever is important is the stuff that happens on screen with me and the character. I don't want to know about what happened in his past or his future. I don't want to know that. I just want to know what's happening in the scene. But then the characters that work in the research for different actors went, no, I'd like to know the backstory. It helps me kind of put the character together and how to play it and stuff like that. So I find stuff like that really interesting. I like the fact that he gives them the choice, but I love the fact that he goes to that much effort. You know, he spends the time and he designs these characters and comes up with these bits of information for the characters that we, the viewer, will never know. He's just hoping will come through in the performance and the design of it. That's what I love about him.
You know, it's like this, right? I still say that I think Guillermo del Toro is at his best when he's the writer and the director.
Yeah.
You know, and I know he can do other stuff, and I know, okay, we get the occasional Hellboy, but I think his best done, like when he's still doing his own thing, he's got coming up Pinocchio. Which sounds like it's going to be a fucking disaster. But when you read it, when you read the sort of the very quick intro of it, the description is a darker version of the classic children's fairy tale of a wooden puppet that transforms into a real living boy. So it sounds like he might have another angle on it. But we'll see. We'll see. That's what's being announced. So let's see what's
I have to just say, I'm completely wrong. And please let me correct myself, that he's not involved in Pacific Rim 2 in the slightest.
Okay.
So I've just said in this podcast that he is giving us Pacific Rim 2 and he didn't give us Hellboy. That's completely wrong. Pacific Rim Uprising, it's called. It's got nothing to do with him. Not directing it, not writing it, nothing. So apologies, that was my mistake.
He probably listened to the podcast we did on it and he sort of bowed out.
Yeah. Now, it's interesting you say about Pinocchio, because I just wanted to bring this up on a side note. A while ago, there was two Jungle Books made. No, sorry, there was a Jungle Book made, a remake of the Jungle Book, the mm-hmm. Disney version.
Yep.
And then there's another one coming out, I think this year or next year. It's a similar thing, much darker, but similar thing. Now you're saying he's doing Pinocchio. Now Robert Downey Jr. is in a production of Pinocchio that's also coming out, that's not been build for any time yet, but it's directed by Ron Howard. And Robert Downey Jr. is the only cast that's listed at the moment as down as Geppetto. So it's interesting how these sort of films come in waves, don't they? Because every now and again you'll get, because also this last year we had two films about Winston Churchill. Darkest Hour got more press, and that's the one in all the Oscars. But there was another one, I think, called Churchill, which was played by might be Michael Gambon. I feel like it was Michael Gambon. Yeah. I forget his name. But
this has happened before.
It's funny how they kind of come in pairs. You know?
I find it a little awkward when this happens because it's a bit like Oasis or Blur. Which one do you like?
I know.
It's a little bit like, well,
you can't. You're not allowed to like both. You're not allowed to like
no,
both.
You can't. No, but it's. I find it. This must be awkward from a Hollywood point of view when you've got two under wraps and then they both go into the production.
They must know, though. They must be aware of what the other studio is thinking.
Surely is no one having a fucking decaf skinny latte in Hollywood with the guy who's from the other thing, you know, Warner's and Universal, you know, sort of chatting. Hey, man, yeah. Hey, Mike, how's it going? Yeah, well, you know, we're just doing this thing called church. What we're doing a thing called... Oh, fuck.
Yeah.
Is it not, like, professionally embarrassing?
Armageddon and Deep Impact.
I know.
White House Down, Olympus Has Fallen.
Yeah, it's just a weird...
It's weird that it seems to still happen.
Yeah.
And like I said, we're getting another Jungle Book now. Now, admittedly, that is going to be... The first one was Disney redoing their Disney film in, you know, kind of real. The next one is going to be more like the Rudyard Kipling book. So it's going to be darker. It's going to be more kind of exploring the characters that aren't in the Disney one. It's a bit more twisted.
Wouldn't it be fun if we got somehow got two Han Solo movies this year? Oh, did I just say Han Solo?
You think we're going to get two? I don't even know if we're going to get one.
There it is. Now we're in. Yes. Now, this is Back to the Podcast. If you just joined us, we're just talking about the new Han Solo movie, which there's no fucking trailer for.
Well, I say that, but today is Sunday. Sunday, what is it? 4th
and
yes, of Feb.
And do you know
and
what?
And in America, it's Super Bowl Sunday today, literally today. I would be surprised if we wake up tomorrow and there wasn't something, even if it's just a poster. But yeah, something's got to happen, surely. Otherwise, we're all just expected to forget. Oh, no, we're not making it this year. No, it's just coming out in a few years' time. We've forgotten. Anyway.
Like a very elaborate April Fool's joke there, just waiting another couple of months. Yeah. I gotcha! Yeah. Like, Marvel, Christ, really, guys? But, you know, Disney, you know, you're all like major players, and it was a good prank. You got us. All 5 billion of us on the planet.
I'm looking forward to what's coming out in Super Bowl Sunday, though. So that'll be nice.
It's definitely Super Bowl Sunday?
Yes, it's today.
We're definitely not having a senior today. Moment. Are you sure?
Okay, yeah, right. Because I've just read all the things about how Justin Timberlake's doing what's it called in sport? The interval. What's the interval?
Well, it's the bit.
The halftime.
Hey, yeah, it's when we have oranges, right?
I'm not good at sport. Neither is Byron, as you can probably tell. I'm good
it's
at sport.
It's when the oranges come out. You know, you have a little orange. Everyone has a bit of orange. It's that bit. Yeah, but apparently segment. In America, it's rather a bigger deal.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's a big old show. Big old hootenanny.
A big old hootenanny. Apparently, it's £1 million a pop. So if you want to do like your commercial for 20 seconds, it's like
in
a
one. That I thought it would be more than that. To be fair. But
or
that's,
minimum.
Well, yeah. But anyway, Shape of Water. Kind of got off topic there. But I mean,
it's a strange beast of a movie. It's a
about
movie.
A strange beast.
It's a strange beast of a movie about. We just did that thing you said about the rhyming thing.
Yeah.
It's a strange beast of a movie about a strange beast.
No, it's not rhyming. It's using the same word.
Using the same thing. The repetition
that means different things.
Yeah. The repetition. So yeah, it's a funny old movie. It's. kind of like an aquatic heist movie with a bit of romance thrown in as well.
I thought it was brilliant. I genuinely really, really enjoyed watching it more than I thought I would. I thought it was going to be, dare I say it, a little bit pretentious, and it is a bit pretentious, but it's a wonderful film with a lot of very interesting themes going on underneath it. Obviously, we've said there's this main plot of the Aquaman and the woman, but then there's a lot of stuff going on underneath that really didn't need to be there, and it's kind of very interesting that it is there, and it makes it more meaty and makes it more interesting to watch.
Yeah, I thought it was going to be actually a bit more violent than it was, and it wasn't. You know, like when they've got the aquatic creature held prisoner and they're sort of torturing it and trying to talk about dissecting it and keeping it prisoner and battling with it. And I thought it was going to be a more violent movie in parts, and I'm actually glad it wasn't.
Yeah,
you know, I'm relieved that it wasn't more, because Toro can do that when he wants to. He has got that sort of range to dip in there and do those moments. So again, I'm kind of relieved that wasn't it in that respect, but it then went the other way.
Yeah,
you know, with the love scene.
Love scene,
which we won't forget for a long time. It was as startling and strange as the one that you get in Team America.
I mean, I have to say, I would have been surprised, but bear in mind the opening scene is her, you know, getting naked, going into a bath and, you know, pleasuring herself. That's not something you see every day in a Hollywood film, you know. So I would have been surprised, but it softened the blow, because I was like, well, you know, we've already had that in the film.
Do you think
so,
that he had to do that to do that bit? So in order to make that scene with when they make out, you know, her and the creature,
yeah,
that preceding, because he does it more than once.
Well, yeah, so we have the scene at the beginning, and then
into it now.
But it's more to show,
definitely,
I think,
R-rated.
She's in this routine, because the opening scene very, very in detail shows her morning routine of, you know, having a bath, knocking one out, eggs, you know, polishing her shoes, and then the next day it kind of goes through all the same stuff again, but very quickly. So I think it's to show that this is her routine, but she's obviously, she likes to dream, she's a dreamer, she's off there thinking about things, people. We're in weird territory now. We should wrap this up.
We should wrap this sucker up right now, Bear, before we get any weird here.
Yeah.
It is a remarkable film. It's not like a lot of films that you'll see elsewhere, which is probably why it's worth checking out, just for the enigma that it is. And there's some great moments in the movie. It's Del Toro doing what he should be doing. I think we can both agree on that.
Right, yeah.
And yeah, it's definitely one to watch, not with the kids, but yeah.
Yeah, but thank you for listening. We are going to wrap this up now. Check out all our social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Back to the Podcast on all. And please continue to listen and support us as you've done over the years. And we are always so grateful, and we will continue to try and bring you new content. But please, if take a minute out of your time and, you know, give us a like, give us a share, subscribe, or whatever you can do to help us, it would be lovely. And we'll see you on the next podcast.